Hello, film snobs. This is Film Snobs, the podcast that teaches you how to be a better film snob. I am co-creator and co-contributor James Owen, coming to you live on tape from my undisclosed location in Mid-Missouri. You may be asking yourself, if you have somehow subscribed to this podcast, hasn't it been a while since they posted? And the answer is yes, it has been. It has been since July of 2023 since I've done one of these. I realized that, with the other co-creator, we were having a little trouble deciding on what our hook was going to be, other than just being a couple of white guys talking about movies. And so I've been trying to figure out what that hook is going to be. I don't know if I've got that figured out, but I've been working on another project, which is going to require me to be more publicity minded. So more on that soon. My guest today, because he's been waiting patiently while I've been explaining myself and trying to justify why I've not been doing this silly podcast, Michael Barrett, who is a lawyer, nonprofit leader, and author. He has written a book called The Hero of Tirna Kara. Did I get that right, Michael?
You did. The Hero of Tirna Kara. That's right.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I was trying to do it in my head. It's an Irish phrase. So I just, you know, I'm a hick from Southwest Missouri. I can't get any of this stuff right. But Michael has written this book. I read it. It's delightful. It's a lot of fun. But I wanted to get him on here to talk a little bit about writing, because he's also written a screenplay, and we want to talk a little bit about what that process is like. Hey, Michael.
How are things, James?
Things are great. Thanks for being on here.
It's been a long time since you and I last spoke and saw each other in person. I hope you're well.
I am well. You and I both have a history of being in Mid-Missouri. You worked in government. I worked in government. We were both controversial leaders of state agencies.
Yeah. Good times.
Yeah. Oh man, I wish for those times back. Considering what we have now.
Yeah.
You are now in upstate New York.
I am. Yeah.
And you are you actually also I believe you also work for an environmental group or kind of a preservation group.
I did for about 5 years. I worked for the Adirondack Mountain Club. Adirondacks, the largest protected land mass in the contiguous United States, about the size of Vermont, exists right here in upstate New York. It's beautiful. 46 peaks, all over 4,000 feet. It's a wonderful place to be.
Wow. So you did that for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I think I thought you were still doing that.
No. You got to keep up.
I am. Clearly, my show prep is lacking a bit.
the army of interns you have in the basement need to up their game.
I do. So I mean, I guess I'll just ask, what are you doing now?
Yeah, I'm running the CEO for Habitat for Humanity in New York State. So another wonderful organization.
Oh my gosh, that is great.
Yeah,
good for you.
Hard to say a bad thing about Habitat for Humanity, right?
Sure isn't.
Who's not behind housing?
Especially affordable housing for people who need it, right?
That's right.
That's awesome. Well,
all while, like you, working on important side projects, right?
Yeah. I don't know how we have time for this, if you want to know the truth.
Well, I think you know, my time is freed up by not playing golf or playing golf so poorly that I don't make it part of my week.
I don't play golf.
Yeah. So this is our answer.
I think that must be our answer. Because I think you've written before. I know we have talked about this before. I think this book is not your first book. It's not your first manuscript.
Right.
Is this your first, is this the first crack at publishing?
Yeah. No. I mean, I think before I left New York the first time for Missouri, I published a what I refer to as a junior varsity crime novel, a sort of Grisham light. These are back in days when you know, I'm sitting in criminal court waiting for my client's case to be called, and I'm doing nothing very productive. So I start writing. You know, it's at the time it seems like a silly enterprise, right? It's never going to amount to anything, but you just keep going at it. And if you enjoy the process, you this is the key, I think, is if you if you're motivated by the outcome, it's oftentimes a short-lived endeavor. If you are motivated because like an amateur guitar player, you just love picking at the strings. If you're motivated by the process, then it has it's sustaining, I think, and it'll typically turn into something.
Well, you have to treat it a little. I mean, it is like any other hobby, a little obsessive, a little bit of a grind. I think, I mean, and I think I've had to treat it like a hobby, in that, you know, practicing law, running a nonprofit. I'm not doing it for a living. I don't really know if there's a lot of people who do writing for a living. It based on my knowledge of the world of literature, it doesn't pay very well so far.
If I think if you're coming out of an MFA program, and this is the typical path, and you know, you start submitting short stories to get published and build your credibility in the writing community, and you're writing something lengthy that your hopes to get published. I would imagine if it's your bread and butter, the joy of writing starts to compete with the ability to put food on the table, and then starts to suck away at the joy over time. I have to imagine that's the case, and that's why you see so few who have it as their primary profession. I think the over the last 5 to 10 years, as self-publishing has shifted from something that was stigmatized to actually a better model for more authors, with the advent of Readzy, which provides all the contract services that you need to publish a professional book. No longer are authors subject to the whims of the publishing industry, which were 15 years ago, you had to have a vampire in your story or you didn't get published, or you know, nowadays it's something else. And so they are tied to trends, and existing audiences. If you have an existing audience that you have cultivated either through a blog or maybe you're an influencer, more likely to get a publishing deal. If you're just somebody who sits in your house and writes a very good book, the merits of that book aside, your chance of being published traditionally are very slim.
So I mean, so you can, I mean, it's almost you, it is like a DIY sort of thing anymore. And that's the route you took.
Yeah, I think that when I wrote my first one, you know, you have to do what's called the query process. You send query letters, and
This is
to
awful.
agents, and you might as well, you know, there's the, you there's times when you where the moon and stars line up, but for most, particularly new authors, you're shouting into the wind, and you know, I think I spent the first year of prior to releasing my first novel, trying to do it the way they tell you to do it, which is to query. And does that mean that the first book wasn't good because it was, well, who knows? Because no one ever, no agent ever requested to read it. So how would anyone know? It's their starting point is what's selling, what they can sell. And so, you know, I moved away from that, and just, you know, this was a time when it was new. The self-publishing world was relatively new. Luckily, I had, you know, in upstate New York, I had small publishing houses that were willing to do the book. But then marketing is all up to you. Now today, the world of self-publishing has become so sophisticated. Print on demand options where they don't even, you know, it used to be where the author would have to buy 500 copies and then try selling them out of the basement through a website or what have you. Now they're print on demand. So if you order a copy of my book, they don't print it until you order it. They're not printing 500 copies of the book at once. They're printing on demand, and this didn't exist 15 years ago.
Right.
So it's that, and you retain the rights. You can decide when it comes out. You can get a professional cover designer so it doesn't look like an amateur effort.
Right.
So we've reached the point, James, where while it's validating to some to be traditionally published, I don't know if it's the preferable model, particularly when it comes to our topic, which is optioning it for for film. I think right. if you're lucky enough to traditionally publish, any agent would be remiss not to sell not just your novel, but the optioning rights, the movie rights to your book. And you're not in a very strong position yet to command a high dollar because you don't know how well your book's going to do. So now I've retained all of my rights. So if the book is well received and people enjoy the story and it catches the attention of some film production company or some screenwriter or director, I'm in a position to negotiate it for my sole benefit.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about that book, The Legal Thriller, that you worked on while you were waiting for a docket call in court, which is, I will admit, when I was in private practice waiting for docket calls, I was just gossiping with other lawyers.
You were not alone.
You were much more productive with that time than I was.
Some days not.
So yeah. but like your process. So you've written this legal thriller, and now you've also written this kind of like, I guess the phrase I would use to describe your new book, The Hero of Tirna Kara. I hope I said it right again.
Fine, yes, it's in the strike zone.
Okay, close. It's kind of a comedy. I mean, would you agree with that? I mean, I thought it was kind of a comedy.
It's an interesting characteristic of the Irish people that make them so endearing, that whether they are going through a rare patch or their typical period of suffering, they do it with humor and wit.
Yeah.
And so it makes them, as I said, an endearing people. And so, you know, as you know, the book, you know, goes up and down from, you know, happy chapters and sad chapters. But
sure.
Even within those sad chapters, I'd like to think that the charm and wit and humor remains.
Yeah. It's all a dramedy, too, we could call it. Like, there are dramatic elements to it, but I generally found it to be kind of a funny, kind of light read.
If you'll let me indulge your listeners, if they've seen the movie Waking Ned Divine, great movie that takes place in Ireland, it's basically the premise is a small Irish village where nothing ever happens until something happens. The book is not dissimilar to that story and that trajectory.
Yeah.
And of course, Waking Ned Divine, the screenplay written by Kirk Jones, who also did Big Fat Greek Wedding and a few other great, great films.
So he's well known if you're into comedies, romantic, or yeah. I don't think Waking Ned Divine's a romantic comedy, but certainly lighter stuff. Yeah. So, okay, that's a good reference point. If that what did that come out in, like the late 90s or mid 90s? I want to say maybe 95. Wish I had a this is when I wish I had a producer.
99. I have the screenplay on my desk because I prepared for your question.
Oh, wow. You're a big fan of this thing.
Yeah, 99, the screenplay was published.
Okay, wow. I would have thought it was earlier than that. Well, okay, so your legal thriller, your Irish comedy. I guess, the first question I feel like I should ask someone who's a writer is like, what draws you to wanting to spend that much time working on a project like that? Like, what's the draw to those particular stories?
So I think, we all have premises that enter our head from time to time. If you have any artistic bent, and certainly the best example of this is stand-ups. They will all walk around with a pad and a pen, right? Because they know premises will come to them, and they don't know if they're fleeting, and so they want to memorialize them as quickly as possible. And then they go to sleep, and then they wake up the next day, and some of those ideas are not as funny as when they first came to them. And then you what you do is you draw a line through them. And then there's that rare premise that sustains itself for weeks and months and sometimes years. And then you realize it's not going away. And I better do something with it because it's going to haunt me if I don't.
So then you just start that process.
Yeah, that start that process. And I think okay, I have this premise. Where do I go from there? Storytelling, it's can be reduced. I mean, we can talk about the trajectory of the hero, and that construct, but I think generally it's intention and obstacle. It is what is the intention of the protagonist, and what is the obstacle that is in her or his way? In other words, what do they want? And what's keeping them from getting what they want? I mean, if you could reduce stories to the most simplest of terms, I think that's not a terrible way to summarize things.
And so, and I mean, you and I talked about this before we decided to talk about this on a recording. You don't do the outline, you don't map this out formally like a like writers. Some writers are told to do that. I think I've heard people be told they need to do that. I don't do that. Why don't you do that?
Yeah, I think, when I hear, when I started off and I hear, oh, you got to outline, what I've come to discover is outlines, certainly in the nonfiction world, but in the fiction world, these front list authors, the Grishams, the James Pattersons, the Baldacci's, they're where they're expected to kick out basically a book a year, which is no small task. And then these are also authors where you see another name on the cover of the book, right? And you're like, well, what's that mean? I mean, of course, where your eyes go is just that familiar surname of Grisham or Patterson, but really, what you're seeing is, okay, I built, I'm James Patterson. I built credibility as an author. I need to milk this for all it's worth. And so I need help. And so you get other writers and you do an outline for them, and they can write like you, they can mimic you. And then you basically have them in your basement, you unlock the door, you throw an outline and a sandwich down, and you have them kick out your next book. So that's the utility of an outline. And for those that are under the commercial deadlines, you could say that there's practical utility as opposed to us more artistic types, where we go where the character that we created takes us. right? You know, that's, you know, I know it sounds silly to say, but if you create, start creating a character and building in characteristics to that character, what happens next with that character is no longer your choice, because either they would behave a certain way or they would not behave a certain way based on how you've constructed them. So that's the approach that I like to take. I like to build off of that premise that I'm committed to, but create the characters and then let the story go where the characters take them.
But and that's good. But I know even with self-publishing, there's considerations of word count, pages. You have to keep all that in mind, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just to start to juxtapose, you know, the novel writing with the screenwriting, I mean, it's two entirely different animals. I mean, this is a great, you know, great way to highlight the differences. I mean, your novel, with some exceptions, particularly in the fantasy or the sci-fi world, where you're doing a lot of world building, which I if you gave me all the money in the world, I couldn't create anything in that genre. But, you know, your typical novel is, you know, between 70 and 90,000 words. You know, I think this one is about 79,000. And that generally, if you use the accepted fonts, it kind of results to around 300 pages, give or take.
Yep, that's about right.
Whereas, you know, that same novel converted into a screenplay is 7,500 to 20,000 words, or 90 pages, with a single page representing, generally speaking, about a minute of footage.
I've always heard that's like the general rule, like a page of a screenplay is about a minute of screen time, because you have also written a screenplay.
Yes.
With your son.
Yes. Who's studying screenwriting at Stanford University.
And is a film critic.
Yes.
for the paper. I've read his stuff.
Yeah, that's great.
It's very cool. I mean, speaking of things that don't make any money, film criticism doesn't make any money, but it is certainly, I mean, again, it is one of those things that I write a column for the Columbia paper every week, just about. I mean, almost without fail, I write it every week. And it's always like, to me, it's like it represents that grind of, okay, I got this idea, I got something I want to talk about, then I got to flesh it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then just, you know, for me, I do want to try to make it relatable to the people that might be reading it, which is, I don't know who reads the newspaper anymore, but I do, like, people tell me they read it, so somebody must read it. But I mean, you know, so film criticism is interesting. It's engaging. It's a good way to keep your mind sharp as a writer.
Gone are the days of Siskel and Ebert, which I grew up on. Right.
Oh my gosh, me too. You know, I mean, Rod, you talk about great writers.
Yeah.
In my opinion, Roger Ebert is one of the great journalists of our lifetime.
Yeah.
As far as like just someone who knew how to like write something that would get your attention. But yeah, even like people like I think about like Peter Travers of Rolling Stone or Pauline Kael,
yeah,
Janet Maslin, you know, there was just Richard Corliss, Todd McCarthy. There's all these like film critics that just don't exist anymore, which is too bad.
And James Owen, failed to mention yourself, which you put out great stuff, and my son Mason Barrett. It certainly enjoys reading it, and you know, his perspective is we're told that these movies are classic movies, they're on posters in his room.
Yeah.
Classic movies. Well, his column reviews those classic movies from a Gen Z perspective. The column is called How About Now? And you know, takes movies like Dracula and you know, through the Gen Z ringer.
I'm not going to lie. I actually had an idea after reading his stuff about doing that with It's a Wonderful Life. Just because I always reference that as being like one of the great Christmas novel, movies. And I actually think it holds up pretty well, and I was going to try to do.
It's a movie that comes out around Christmas time about the importance of banking regulations and the dangers of concentrated wealth, right? Is that the movie you're referring
Yes.
to?
Yeah. And you know, and yeah, and also, yeah, just yeah, the oligarchy really that Mr. Potter represents.
Yeah.
No, I but so your son, okay, so your son is studying screenwriting, and you so you took upon your you and him wrote a screenplay together.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah. So, he went off to film camp each of the last couple of summers, and the second summer, the school of give him a shout out, School of Creative Performing Arts. He did a 2-week screenwriting course, and so he comes home with all of this knowledge, and it's esoteric, right? It's its own thing. Screenwriting is its own thing. You know,
Right.
you write a letter, a typical letter, and you can take that format and turn it into other things. But even if you don't know how to screen write, if you picked up a screenplay, you know what you have in your hands. It's not anything else, right? It looks a certain way. So he comes home with all this knowledge, all this new knowledge about, what goes in, and more importantly, what does not go into
Right.
a screenplay. And boy, it'd be a shame if we didn't do anything with that. And so, for the, for,
Yeah.
you know, if, so if folks are out there saying, well, how do I get started? Is the Barrett family going to send me to screenwriting camp? No, but I will point you in the right direction. You need, just a few things. I think I would start with the Hollywood Standard, which is a great screenwriting book. It's got a yellow cover. It's in my opinion, generally regarded as the manual for screenwriting in Hollywood, the Hollywood Standard. I'll say it again. And then you need some screenwriting software. I think the standard is Final Draft. Final Draft is probably the standard. For screenwriters, there's some variations. Those are the two things off the shelf that you could, and then buy yourself a screenplay online and just take a read through a few of them.
Yeah.
And you're going to need to do it because you're going to need to unlearn novel writing. You cannot you it takes the utmost di discipline to stop thinking like a novel writer. And the starting point for it is accepting that when you write a novel, you're writing it for the reader.
Right.
Does anyone have a qualm with that? I mean, that's who you're writing it for. You're
Sure.
telling the reader a story, and you're creating it in their head for them. A screenplay is anything but. It's not for the reader. It's not for the general readership, I should say. It's only for generally three professions: the actor, the
Yep.
director,
Yep.
and the cameraman or camerawoman, right?
Right. An instruction. It's almost an instruction.
It is. It
Yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And the less the better.
Right.
Particularly for the director and the actor, because you're not telling it's their job, and you're stepping on their toes with too much direction in your screenplay. You know,
Right.
on with rare exception, are you providing a descriptor? You're telling them what the character is doing. You're telling them what the character is saying, but the way that the character goes about it, that's the profession of the actor. That's the profession of the director, and it's best for the screenwriter to stay out of their way on that.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, and I mean, you pick up a screenplay, and I mean, of course, a lot of screenwriters are, I mean, especially one that's like going to be published. I mean, you know, a good example of this is Tarantino. He's published a lot of his screenplays. He puts a lot of detail in there, but he's also like wants to direct it. I mean, I think he's
Yeah.
almost doing it as
For
like,
him, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, there's a certain argument to be made. As a director, you can put a little more detail in there. But yeah, you're basically saying like, well, this is where the scene's set. This is what people are going to say, and this is what this is like. They're, I mean, you almost, I guess, you do have to have some stage direction in there. Yeah.
I mean the first element to the format is basically tells the director and the camera operator, where are we? Where are we? So the first line is abbreviation for either interior or exterior. So
Right.
the beginning of every scene, you will see either EXT period or INT period. Okay. So now you've told them a whole lot, right? You've told them whether we're indoors or whether we're outdoors. And then where specifically are we? I'll just read a line from the Waking Dead Divine. The scene begins interior, Ned's living room, night. That's all you need there, you know. And then there's you go down to what's happening in that room. Okay. And then it's dialogue. Those are the three elements. So the scene set, or also called a slug line, what's happening, and dialogue. These are the three primary elements. And you know, there's in the weeds type stuff, like if it's a voiceover or there's someone's talking but the camera doesn't see them, there's all kinds of codes or acronyms you can use for that. But generally those are the three, and it's not the three elements, and it's not any more complicated than that. It just requires the discipline for someone who's not a screenwriter to stick to that and be like, no, I have to tell them more. No, you don't.
Right.
Yeah, no, you don't.
So when you write it with another person, like let's say your kid, your son, what's the process there? Are you talking it out? Are you assigning each other different things? How does that work in your process?
Well, you know, there's we have, and this is not a model process, but we have the 1.0 and the 2.0 version. The 1.0 is I just took a stab at converting the story as is told in the book to a screenplay. But you know, how often do we say, well, the movie was quite different than the book, where we said it's most one of the most cliche things. And him as the budding screenwriter, I handed it over to him, and said, do what you want with it. And so
This is based on your book.
based on the book, and do what you want with it. And he wrote it from more of a three act perspective. That was quite different. And so, you know, he's, I, you know, he's, I, he has the green light to run with it in whatever direction he wanted. And so the 1.0 is quite different from the 2.0. So that was generally our process.
Okay, so you write
Two
a draft,
iterations.
he writes a draft.
Yeah.
Okay. And you find that, I mean, you talk about that three act structure. I mean, was there anything else that was
Yeah, I mean, generally, I mean,
right?
he's taken a lot of storytelling classes, and so it follows the general, you know, hero takes a fall, hero has to redeem himself or herself, and then there's some sort of achievement at the end. I mean, that's the oversimplified three act
Yeah.
structure. So
So I mean, it's quite a household you've got there.
I don't, you know, yeah, I don't know what else we'd be doing. We don't do fantasy football or golf, or
Right.
you know, I mean, it's not additional. It's just time that's available because we don't do other things that so many other
Right.
people do. So
So what is your plan with that screenplay then?
I'm very, you know, I wrote my version. I was motivated to write my version, just to implement some of these techniques that I was learning from going through the Hollywood Standard, that book I alluded to earlier. And so it was really just an exercise for me. I'm very happy. You know, I'm trying to network with the the film community in Ireland to try to hand this over and say, you know, do what you want with it. And I think, you know, there's two approaches for writers. You know, there's, you know, those who are, you know, absolutely possessive of their work, and they will not let it turn into something unless they are inextricably tied to it. And there's the old take the check and throw the book over the fence to the screenwriters and walk away. There's that approach too. And you know, for you and I and so many others who have that full-time job, have the family, have, you know, our other pursuits, we may be inclined to be front and center on the development of our work, but do, right. You know, do we have the luxury of that time? You know, I don't know if we do.
I don't know if we do, but yeah. You've already done it. You've already written the screenplay at least.
Yeah, but you know, it could, the 3.0 is a screenwriter yeah. who is worth her salt will say, hey, this is a nice effort here. But let me take it from here. Yeah. Fair enough. I mean, I'm very pleased with the outcome of the book. My goal at this point is to get in front of as many eyes as I can.
Yeah.
And then if somebody thinks that there is legs for a film, great. And I'm happy to hand it over at that point.
So with your book, The Hero of Tir na Cara.
Yeah.
Since you're on here, well, how do people find it?
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way is on Amazon.
Where I learned 70% of books are sold in this country.
Yeah,
right.
We all bow to that God at the moment. Which you know, it shouldn't be so sarcastic because I mean Bezos. I mean the beginnings of Amazon was not to sell you your household cleaning products. It was to sell you books. It was the beginning. The first product was a book. It was an online bookstore. And so we're all grateful. But yeah, it's the behemoth. So yeah, I mean, you just get on Amazon and search The Hero of Tir na Cara. That's TirnaCara. You'll find it. I'm appreciative of the reviews that have been left, all fives. So I'm appreciative of that. You know, I certainly don't mind deviations from that. I'd rather have more people with eyes on it.
So, I mean, like, you know, this being your hobby, your passion, I mean, what are you doing to market it? What do you do?
You and I are on a Zoom call and you probably see some of the gray hairs on the side of my head, which translates to I'm lousy at social media. This is a conversation about modern day publishing. The upside is it's a very democratic small D. It's available to anyone, but who has a leg up is if you told me I had a choice between writing a really good book, but not knowing how to market it versus being prolific on social media with a built-in audience and write a substandard book, it would generate some mixed thoughts because those that are constantly recording themselves and connecting with an audience, they may not be writing the best books, but boy, are they selling a lot. And if you're on TikTok and you're putting yourself out there, you're gangbusters.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that certainly to me feels like a different skill.
Yes, it is a different skill. Yes. And then,
yeah. And the people who can balance it and juggle it, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I'm sitting here on the precipice of having a book get published. And I'm sitting here thinking, how in the world am I going to do all of this? And I will confess, it's caused me a little bit of anxiety. Everything kind of causes me anxiety, but it causes me a little anxiety and thinking like, well, I want people to read this.
Yeah.
People to know what's out there. But I mean, am I ready to? I mean, nobody wants to see me on TikTok.
Yeah, no, I feel the same.
My nonprofit has a TikTok account, but that's why I've got college students
Yeah,
working for me.
that's
And I
right.
basically said to them, don't get me fired and don't cause us to lose our tax exempt status, and you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, that's pretty good direction. It is challenging, and maybe there was an old way of thinking where you weren't supposed to quote, I think the phrase is toot your horn,
Yeah.
and you and I and countless others are trying to unlearn that, and so that we can do what the acceptable strategy now is for
Right.
everything, which is it's not something to be ashamed about, recording yourself and saying, hey, you should read or watch or look at my work. You and I might shy away from that, because we're of a certain age, but others are not, and we need to be okay with that. And it's not easy to do.
Yeah, I guess I just got to find the time to sell out. I mean, I'm ready. I'm ready to do it. I just need to find the time to do it. I'm sitting there thinking, like, I got to set up a Blue Sky account. I don't want, like, why do I need another thing on my phone? But I mean, but it's what you got to do. Well, I mean, I hope people read this book. I enjoyed this book a lot. I hope people find it. I hope someone makes a movie out of it. I actually think it would work really well as a movie. Very colorful characters, kind of has an, I mean, to me, it has this kind of interesting turn that I didn't really see coming, which is very, very sweet and very, very, and very clever. So I hope people get to explore that story a little bit. So.
I hope so too, and I thank you for taking the time and giving it a shot and reading it and for all you do on this podcast to connect with those who are out there loving movies and want to love movies on a whole different level.
So that's it's very cool. Well, Mike, Barrett, Michael, thank you. And thank you all for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to this on any major platform where you get your podcast needs. Leave a review. Reviews are very important to amplify the message, and also share this on your social media posts on your social media platforms. On behalf of filmsnobs.com, this is James Owen wishing you a wonderful day and an even better tomorrow. Take care.